Good afternoon. Thanks for not abandoning campus early, as some people seem to have a habit of doing. So we're going to try to finish up talking about return-oriented programming today. So last time you started looking at tracing return-oriented programming chains, so figuring out like why does this idea of overwriting the return address with something and then having more stuff after it work, and the idea is that that something typically will read from more of the stack, such as by trying to return again. And, well, on x86, that works by popping the next thing from the stack or popping other things from the stack. And we saw that this kind of let us write little programs. We have this kind of little programming language where we have these primitives, which are going to be different for every program and library we're trying to exploit, but kind of ultimately give us, usually it turns out, a full programming language. Full in the sense of you can do anything that the program could do. And we looked at kind of some exercises where we had to assemble things manually, which is always an option. And to do that, well, we wanted to find out what the gadgets, the little snippets of assembly we could run with. We mentioned that there's programs that automate the process, and those programs, what they're doing is conceptually simple. Implementing it, not simple, but conceptually simple. They're looking for the opcodes that represent calls, jumps, and returns, things that could be the end of a gadget, and they're just going backwards from that, trying to disassemble it, seeing and sorting those results. And on the assignment that's due the week after break, you'll be using one of those tools. And we mentioned that those tools have this way where they heuristically find kind of a useful chain that's kind of hard-coded, and maybe some more sophisticated tools will give you ways of like specifying more properties about that, where we can kind of automate large parts of this process. So we saw the example with ROP gadget, which is the tool that most of you will use in the upcoming assignment. We don't require you to use that specific tool, but we have instructions in the assignment for it. What it does is it generates a chain that does, ROP gadget does basically exec exec VE, bin sh, and other irrelevant arguments. And this is, which is the, which is run a shell. And once we're running a shell, you can insert shell commands. And something we kind of glossed over is that like we're kind of assuming we're exploiting at the terminal, so we're going to run the commands as more input to the program. If this were in the context of like something on the network, there's some extra steps to like set it up so the shell takes input from the network. But that's another thing that's can be, like, isn't with ROP gadget, but can be part of these sort of canned chains, is running the extra operations needed to make it so we can access something from the network. Then we talked about applying these ROP chains ideas to other contexts. So, so far it's looked like return-oriented programming is a substitute for stack smashing, that we broke stack smashing with writex or execute. Even if we had all the information leaks in the world, we just had the program print out the contents of its stack and all the addresses when it started, just to help our exploit. Still couldn't do it with writex or execute. So return-oriented programming, saved us from that because we could still use the stack overflows. But often, we're going to want to exploit something that isn't a stack overflow. So something maybe more like what we see in the subterfuge assignment, where we have an overflow and some variables on the heap. And in the subterfuge assignment, it happens to be the case that we can just replace one function pointer and it does what's immediately useful to us, what we called arc injection, that idea that there's a function that already exists in the program that does everything we want. But in the real world, often we can't find such a function. And we can use these same return-oriented programming techniques to, you know, solve that problem by chaining together gadgets, except it's going to be a little trickier to chain them together because we won't have something on the stack that we control immediately. So we're going to need to be a little more clever and, you know, either look for some gadget that lets us change the stack pointer to something that we control, and then we use what we use for a buffer overflow on the stack, or look for a way of running a gadget that jumps somewhere and if I'm making it so the place it jumps is something that will jump in a way that's also based on what we control without using a return. And both of these are possible, but obviously a lot more programs specific. But, you know, even though this seems like pretty tricky, this is kind of your only option in a lot of cases, and is likely the strategy that kind of a lot of modern exploits use. Because, well, for example, the Chrome browser, you know, cares about security and has for a couple decades. So, for at least a decade. So they have enabled all these mitigations, and typically it's not a stack overflow when there is a bug in there. So you have to exploit it using these techniques, and that's what people have done. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? And since I'm here, also, any questions on the site that's up, the subterfuge assignment? No? Okay. So let's do a little exercise here. So let's say I make an ROP chain that does something useful to me. And I want to use it to exploit this function where I read in two words from standard in, two space-separated words. This is going to be how scanf works in this case. And I've constructed my ROP chain, so when it's working out as binary, it has no wait space. So that will work. And my question is, how do I write my input to this function to make this ROP chain get run? Which is, by the way, extremely related to what you're going to need to do for the ROP assignment. So, I'll give you, check with your neighbor, see if you agree what design it is. And I guess a good first step is like figuring out what does the stack look like for this. Oh, I have, I did a stupid, okay. Or is it, it's the answer is in fact none of these. So what is the correct answer? I see. So I will correct this slide for future semesters. So one of the answers is correct. But what is closest to the correct answer, and how do we fix it to be correct? And I will so note that, yeah, I will correct the slide because I did some bad counting. Because I didn't actually test this. Oh, I did some very bad counting. Yeah. So I'm off by a lot. Okay. So let's just say, so we'll just ignore these answer choices and we'll say we have, so I guess the first question is which of these formats do we have? Do we have format one, format two, or format three? Which of these can work? and then we'll talk about what the number is, because I have one of the number I have is wrong. Sorry, I just computed things wrong and didn't realize. This is the problem with making slices this morning. Didn't think about it carefully enough when I was making this one. And I made the stupidest arithmetic error as my primary error. So which format is right? So we have the format where we make our first word be some padding and then the ROP chain, and then we put some junk in the second one. We have the format where we have our first word be the ROP chain, some padding, and then then anything for the second word, and then we have the format where I make the second word be some padding and then my ROP chain. But we'll just scratch out these and just say question mark as we'll figure out what those numbers should actually be. So who thinks we should, option one, that we can do it with having our first word be some padding and then the ROP chain, and the second word just being, you know, a placeholder like X? Thinks that is possible? Is not possible? No clue? Okay. How about option two, that we make our first word be the ROP chain, then some padding, then the address of the ROP chain. And the second word, we just use some placeholder. Thinks that is viable, that is not viable. No clue? Okay. And how about our fourth option, which is that we make the first word be some placeholder and the second word be some padding and then the ROP chain. You think that's viable? That is not viable? No clue? Okay, so we have a big mix. I am really annoyed that I didn't look at the answer clearly. And do I have? I can do that, I can do this, and we can just, make some space for drawing here. Okay, so let's talk about I would say option one and three can work. So what we want to do is we're going to have our first and our second, and then we're going to have RBX, and then we're going to have the return address on the stack. And to start executing the ROP chain, we want the ROP chain to be here, right? Because to start executing it, we want to first pop the beginning of it from the stack when we're running this return instruction. And so there are kind of two options for doing that. So one option is that we overwrite first. So we overwrite starting here, and we make it so that means that in our overwrite of first, we have a bunch of padding to get to where the return address is, and then we put our ROP chain, and that's going to be processed by popping off the first bit, and that might run something that pops more stuff off the stack, and it will just keep going kind of to higher memory addresses. Because remember, the stack grows in this direction. So when we're popping things from the stack, it goes in the other direction, which is increasing addresses. So another option that would also work is that we could also overflow the second number, the second string, and do the same. Now, the idea of setting the return address to point somewhere, to point to some other chain, that's I think a common point of confusion, is that the thing we put in the return address is not the address of more stuff to put on the stack. It's the address of our little snippet of code to run, which is not part of our chain. Our chain contains no actual machine code. So we're never going to set the return address to actually point to it, or any address that gets returned to, because we're never going to run it as code. The whole point of return-only programming was that we can't run code on the stack. So we don't want to set the program counter to point to the stack. So any strategy which involves taking the address of the chain and putting it as a return address, not going to work. We're going to try to execute something that's not machine code as machine code, and it's not an executable memory, just going to crash. So questions on that? Nice idea. So those are, yes?
Clarify, you're overwriting the return address with the point in memory you want to jump to start running the address.
Yes, so we're overwriting the return address with the point in memory we want to jump to start running the chain. So right, remember our chain might be, you know, if this is increasing addresses, we might have a pointer to like pop RDI rent, right? That might be a component of our chain. So we'll jump to set our program counter to point to, I guess I should draw this in the same rate. That does not work with what I've just done on this slide. So I'll just draw this on a better slide. So we'll set, so our setup is that we have our first, our second, we have RBX in the code, and then we have our actual return address, and then the rest of our chain. And the idea is that this is going to, we're going to set this up to point to something like, say, pop RDI rent. And when that runs, it's going to, we're going to have our PC pointing here, and that's going to take this thing off the stack. So our stack pointer is going to be here, and then we're going to advance to the next instruction. So our PC is going to point at the ret, and our stack pointer is going to point here, and this is going to be a pointer to the next thing in the chain to run. You know, say, you know, maybe it's RX. Oh, yeah, you know, something like that. And that will be where we go afterwards. So that's what we're writing on the stack, is those addresses. And it needs to be placed such that this whole thing here, this is our chain. And I guess based on this response, I should have made more slides to review this. Sorry about that. I thought this exercise would be ignoring that I messed up the numbers in it, you know, would be relatively, we mostly understand this, but that is not the case. So definitely need to be careful of that. So that's the idea. So we're overwriting the return address. We need to go there first, run our little bit of a gadget, on the next little bit of a gadget, and our tools are giving us, you know, this whole chain. And remember that this is increasing addresses the way I'm drawing things. So our tools, this is the first part of what our tool gives us, is that thing that goes to over the return address. Okay, so questions? So let's now apply to here, figure out what our stack layout is. So we have RBX is pushed on our stack. Then we subtract A0, which unlike what I did. So there's two mistakes I made when writing the numbers on this question. One is I forgot to account for the push RBX. The other is I wrote A0 and said, oh, that's 100. And it is not 100. So that's a problem. It is 160. So we have push RBX on the stack. So this is 8 bytes from our return address. And then we add 100, subtract 160 from our return address. And the address of second is 50 hex plus that, or 80 plus that. So here is second at 80. And the address of first is at that. So our stack layout, going back to this picture, is that we have, this is actually, even though we declared it as 50 bytes, the compiler decided to allocate 80 bytes for it for some reason. Looks like 80 bytes. And this is also 80 bytes. And then we have, this is the saved RBX, which is 8 bytes. So the amount of padding we need to add if we're storing something in first is 160 plus 8 bytes, 168 bytes, and 88 bytes if we're storing it in second. Questions? For example, and I will sometime later today, I will try to put together a clean explanation for the exercise and put it in the ROP slide deck, since this seems definitely one to be careful of. Yes?
This is a little unrelated, but on the substitution work, there was like a reference to like the special get check where like make sure you don't overflow a buffer. Like,
yeah. So you're asking about the get, so in the assignment there's something gets check, this sort of extra checking version of gets that the compiler generates. Like, the question is, what size does that use? The compiler generates it, and I have some slides about this later, but it's basically, it's the best bound the compiler's optimizer figured out. Yeah, so we'll talk about that later, because our topic after ROP, if you look at the schedule, is bounds checking. So that is one thing we'll talk about with bounds checking is those features, those check functions, which in GCC and Clang are controlled, in the Linux C library, more than just GCC and Clang, but are controlled with the fortify source option, which is these days on by default for obvious reasons. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's do so we talked about last time we're doing a function pointer overwrite. So this is I'm getting some input that can overwrite this function pointer here. And let's say, I don't have a convenient function that does what I want right away. So I overwrite it with the address of this gadget. And the question is, what do I put at the beginning of the input? or do none of these work? Well, she should add a F none of these. So my input, what I'm supplying to get S, is going to be something, some padding, and then a pointer to this push RDX jump star RDI. And I guess I'll also mention or existing function or next gadget, right? It's a special case of an existing function. Who would like some more time? So which of these options would work? And we're, you know, saying that we might use shellcode, we might use ROP. But our first step is an ROP-like gadget. And the question is, how can we make this attack continue further? If we're running shellcode after this, maybe we could have done something simpler. But, you know, that just says, oh, well, we did it more complicated than we need to. So who thinks, A, that this will cause us to try to run the input as machine code? Okay, how about B, this will cause us to try to run the input as an ROP chain? C, that this will cause us to find a pointer from the input? Okay. D, this will cause us to use the input as an ROP chain? And E, this will be used, we want to make this work, we want to have a return instruction. Who thinks that's useful? So we have some for E. And who thinks F, none of these? Okay, so we have some for C and some for E. So the C option works. So we import something that is not a valid string, so scanf fails. And we really don't care. This program forgot to check scanf's return value, so it doesn't know that scanf failed. So this pushes something on the stack that is uninitialized. Maybe that's useful. And then jumps to wherever we put whatever we put at the beginning of the string interpreted as an address. Probably, this is either not, we should have just overwritten the original return address with something, or we should have, or we have a reason we want RDX on the stack to run that thing. That would be the one case where this might be useful. If we have something that is going to pop from the stack, then RDX is useful. So the other option is that we could do the habit pointer return. And why would that be useful? Well, RDX is the address, it would become the address of a string, and we jump to somewhere, and then have that on the top of the stack. And maybe we want to return to, the address of that string. That seems kind of useful. The problem is that we need to have a number that printf accepts that's also a valid memory address. So that seems a little tricky. And printf needs to accept it because, scanf needs to accept it because it won't read into here unless this format string works. It will just stop. Okay, some questions? Yes. Okay, so I have a couple other topics I'd like to talk about with ROP. Questions on this exercise before I do that. But I'm gonna talk about some things that, the kind of obvious idea for ROP defense, which is don't have gadgets. Can we do that? And also about, I'd like to kind of give us a high level overview of something rather remarkable called blind ROP attacks, meaning attacking a program you don't have source code or executable code for with ROP attacks. First, so questions on this exercise. Okay, so people have looked into, can we get rid of gadgets? There's kind of two issues. So one is that, we want to get rid of the unintended jump and write instruction. We saw that a lot of instructions had the intended reading, and then they had another reading where, like, we started in the middle of the instruction and suddenly there was a ret there, or a pop there, that wasn't ever really written in the real program. The other thing is we want to make existing ret and also jump instructions not, be useful as part of a gadget. And sort of one way of doing that would be to add something like stack canaries and do something equivalent to stack canaries, where we have some secret value the attacker would need to control for around our jump instructions, computed jumps. Another idea might be something like a shadow stack. And we'll talk about some much more sophisticated ideas for that later in the semester when we talk about something called control flow integrity. And the hope of this paper was exploring this in 2010, and they, hoped that they would get rid of all the useful gadgets. Now, their technique, is kind of partial, right? Because it kind of assumes no information leaks, and you might say, can we really, if we're assuming they're going to defeat ASLR, can we really assume they're not going to get the canary values, or the equivalent of those? And that's a tricky thing. You might imagine maybe we could protect the canary values by like never writing them to memory or something like that if you had an extra register. But, it seems like this paper is kind of being a stretch. And even with that kind of compromise, their performance results are good, but you're probably not going to convince people to use this on random programs. So their time overhead, pretty good, 0 to 6%. Space overhead, 20 to 30%. Not very great. So the big thing they had to do is get rid of, these variants, these unintended return instructions. So they needed to transform assembly all these cases where we had these unintended ones. So for example, this add of C2 to EAX, C2 0000 is a variant of the return instruction. So that's going to be useful in gadgets. kind of unfortunate. So they have to get rid of that. So we're going to change this constant. We're going to change this constant. So they just change the constant to C1 and add an increment instruction. But that's the sort of thing we have to do to make this happen. Not very elegant. The other thing they did is that they, you know, when there were part overlapping instructions that could be interpreted as a gadget, so in this case we have a move followed by a rotate left, so bit rotation, so a bitwise operation instruction, we have this return that is another reading of these instructions. So to avoid that, they add a bunch of knops whenever they detect that scenario between instructions. Again, not very elegant, but you can do it. So yeah, this is a real idea. People have thought about it. You know, I think you can see the reason we don't do it is like it's really ugly. And not very efficient, at least as far as space. Like you probably wouldn't be happy if like a bunch of your application downloads, you know, went from 1 meg to 1.3 megs or 10 megs to 13 megs. It's not a great story. So there are other defenses that we'll talk about probably later. So I mentioned control flow integrity, where the sort of simple idea of control flow integrity is that we make all our returns verify they're going to somewhere after a call. And we make all our calls and jumps verify they're going to one of the intended destinations somehow. Another idea is something called pointer authentication, where basically we have a cryptographic message authentication code in our pointers so that you can't generate pointers that are valid, that are signed as an attacker. And I hope to talk about both of these later in the semester. We'll see how time goes, because these are kind of the most modern and most practical actual defenses to these classes of attacks. For pointer authentication, obviously, but the practical implementations I'm speaking of have hardware support. Like, you can do it without hardware support, but seems kind of slow to be checking cryptographic stuff all the time without hardware help. But there is hardware support in ARM, notably, some ARM systems to do that, so it is actually real and deployed. Okay, so questions about referring to like the quote-unquote obvious idea for getting rid of ROP, which is why are all these gadgets here, and our preview of some future defenses. Okay, so in our remaining time, I'll talk about this work from Stanford from a few years ago, from 2016, I guess more than a few years ago, called Blind ROP. And you know, I'm showing this, I think this is a good illustration of a bunch of things we're saying. So this is using an information leak and doing, using what seems like a small information leak to do ROP attacks on a program, despite stack canaries and address space reliable randomization. And also to do it on a program where you don't know what the executable actually looks like, except that you know it's like a Linux executable that is compiled normally, right? Isn't obfuscated or something. And the scenario they're looking at, what made this practical is, you know, they need some setup. And they're relying on a server where we have some automatic restarting and we have a bunch of worker programs that have the same randomization. And there's kind of two ways this happens a lot in practice. So one way is that when we talked about ASLR, you mentioned that some systems like Windows, and I think also OS X, use an ASLR strategy where they choose a place to load things once for each boot, and they just keep using that. So if you restart a server on those systems, the addresses will be the same until we reboot, unless something else happens that unloads the libraries or whatever. On Linux, the randomization is different each time you run the program, but a common way servers are structured is that basically we'll have a template process that will be duplicated to produce the actual worker processes, rather than starting from scratch. So if you took CSO2, you learned about fork. Fork is one way this would happen. And we're imagining we have, like, you know, sort of this kind of pseudocode, that we're running a server, and we have a vulnerability where it reads from the network into a stack buffer, and that's a trivial stack overflow. And if this were, you know, no randomization, no stack canaries, we just do stack smashing, and it would be fairly easy, and we could probably figure out how to do it, and people did in the past, without copies of the executable or the source code, because we just say, maybe this is on the stack. I'll guess what the typical stack address is without randomization, and put some shell code and a big knob sled, and I'll just try a bunch of stack addresses until it works. And this is a real thing people did, is that they, you know, with stack smashing, exploited servers without knowing what the server code looked like or the assembly. So we're going to apply this idea to defeating our two protections. So we're going to start by defeating stack canaries. And you might say, wait a moment, don't we need an information leak? And it turns out we have one. So can someone tell me, what's the information leak here? Why do we have an information leak? Like, what information will our attacker get? There's something, we'll learn something about the program based on our input, and you can tell from just this that we'll learn it. Yeah?
When you make a new process, don't you get a copy of the stack?
Don't you get a copy of the stack? That's true, yes. If we're making a new process like Linux typically does with fork, you get a new copy of the stack. That's not, all we need in this case is that the stack, you know, uses the same randomization and the same stack canary. So the information leak, the information we're going to learn, and kind of the key idea behind this, the people at Stanford who came up with this blind ROP idea, is that we have a signal in, does the server crash? If it crashes, our connection will get aborted prematurely. If it doesn't, it won't. So, for example, we can kind of trivially use that to figure out how far from the beginning of the buffer is the stack canary. If we input not that many bytes, it will not crash. And if we input more than that many bytes, it'll probably crash. But there's a second possibility. Just that, you know, we have our buffer, our stack canaries, let's say right above it. If we input just one extra byte, then there's two possibilities, depending what we put in that one extra byte. One possibility is that we happen to accidentally match the first byte of the stack canary, in which case the server won't crash. We'll just keep going. The other possibility is that it didn't, and the server will crash. And so we can just keep trying values and one byte by byte. And this idea, the authors of the paper called stack reading. That we can read the stack canary by seeing if we are not changing it. Because when we change it, the program crashes. And when we don't change it, the program behaves the way it did before. And this just requires 256 tries at most, usually less, for each byte. So questions on this idea? So that gets us the stack canary value. So that defeats stack canaries. So we successfully have an information leak where we've learned the stack canary value, and the stack canaries don't actually help that much. How about ASLR? So how are we going to defeat address space layout randomization? Because we also want to know the addresses of things. Well, we're going to apply the same idea once we figured out the whole stack canary. Let's just keep going. We're going to overwrite the first byte of the return address. And if we keep it the same, the program behaves the same. If we don't keep it the same, probably the program does something weird. So we can read the return address. Yeah. So if we this way, and we can again do that byte by byte, and that's going to tell us where the return address is, and if we had the executable code, that would be enough to de-randomize the program, because we know where the program was loaded based on knowing, you know, this buffer overflows in this function, which is called from here, therefore that place it's called from has this address, and now we know we can do the math and figure out where everything else in the program is. So questions on this idea of this stack reading idea, that we have this overflow in the stack and we have this property that the program gets restarted after a crash and most of our changes that don't match the stack cause a crash. So the big trick that the blind ROP paper does is a step beyond this. So we have this idea where we can kind of randomly, you know, change things on, randomly overwrite things, you know, byte by byte, and see what happens. And so far it seems like that just tells us like what the correct value was, which is still very, very useful. The other thing we can do is once we know what the return address is, we know that if there are gadgets in the program, they are around the return address. So we can guess the candidate addresses for gadgets. So the key kind of building block the blind ROP paper uses is that we try replacing the return address with nearby addresses and see how the program behaves. And we kind of use this to experimentally figure out what those gadgets do. And this might seem like, oh, well, we can't possibly get there. And the way that they made this attack practical is that they know that a typical program is going to have certain types of gadgets in it, notably that will typically have a sequence of returns. And I'm going to show the slide from where is the slide? What they're trying to look for is a gadget like that, where it pops a whole bunch of stuff from the stack, and then they can use parts of that, it turns out, because of how the x86 encoding works, to get things that set RSI and RDI, which usually aren't popped. Because the encoding, if you read in the middle of pop R14 and R15, becomes RDI and RSI. So that's kind of what they're looking for. And the key insight they use to be able to kind of experimentally search for candidate gadgets is kind of two things. So the big building block they use is that they look for a gadget that stops the program and one that hangs the program. And once they find that, then you can try to tell if you have a gadget that pops anything from the stack. Because if you have a gadget that's pop then return, and you put this thing that might pop followed by something that will stop the program, followed by something that will hang the program, I should say, followed by something that will crash the program. If it's actually pop then return, the program will crash. If it's just return, do something and return, the program will hang. So they can use that to tell how much gadgets do a stack. So their kind of outline of their attack, and we're just going to give the high level, especially for time, is that they use this technique to look for a gadget that pops a lot of stuff from the stack, because that's a very common thing to find in real functions. And it probably sets a lot of registers, which is really useful. Then they look for the string comp function. They know that it's probably in the procedure linkage table, which is probably at a particular lower addresses relative to your program because of how Linux lays out executables. And they know that it behaves a particular way when our two registers are set to valid or invalid memory addresses, which they can try to do by sort of experimenting with things to put after the gadget that pops a bunch of stuff. And then they try to figure out what the write function is that can write to the network. And then they try to write the program's machine code to the network, and then you just do the attack normally. Because you now have the executable, you can do all the things you do when you have the executable loaded into Kahedra or whatever. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. Sorry I went over time. I will try to make a clean version of that first exercise, since that's relevant to the next homework.